Hello and welcome. This is D. Garrett Nadeau presenting one of a number of podcasts on behalf of the Lancashire Authors Association. Today's guest is Nick Oldham. Welcome, Nick.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's great to have you here. Can you tell us a little bit about your early background, about your connection with Lancashire and your youth?
Yes, I can. As my surname probably gives it away, Oldham, my family actually are from Oldham itself. But just after the war, we moved to Belthorne, which is just above Blackburn, and pretty much spent quite a lot of time there until we actually moved then to Oswaldwistle. So I was born in Belthorne. I was actually born in a house in Belthorne. I wasn't born in hospital or anything.
Yeah.
And actually, if you, as I've done today, if you drive along the M65 from where I live now in Preston, along the way, you look up and you can see Belthorne. You can actually still see the gable end of the house where I was born.
So I always kind of
look up, and it always has a little bit of a draw for me.
Sure, Belthorne. Of course. Were your brothers and sisters born in the house as well?
Or? My eldest brother was born in Oldham, and I have two. I have three brothers. The other two were born in Belthorne and Blackburn.
Yeah,
and my sister was born in Belthorne.
Okay.
So we're pretty much Lancashire people, yeah. I would say.
So you went to school in the Lancashire area?
Yeah, I went for my Accrington. Junior school, first of all, was in Belthorne.
Right.
And again, the only accolade that had was at that time, it was the highest school in the country, up on the hill, at the top of the hill. It doesn't exist anymore.
Yeah.
But then when we moved to Oswaldwistle, I then went to school in Oswaldwistle at junior school. And subsequently went to Accrington Grammar School and then Accrington College.
Yeah. And, but after that, when you started work, I think you started work in a bank?
I started to work for Barclays Bank in Clitheroe.
Right.
So I travelled every day from Oswaldwistle via on the bus to Clitheroe. So it was a bit of a tedious journey, but it was on that way, I think, that I didn't really like working in the bank. I didn't like the constriction of working in an office particularly. And the idea kind of evolved as I was on my journeys and seeing police officers knocking about, and that I thought, I wouldn't mind being a cop, actually. And I met one quite often who was standing on the steps of the bank with his hands clasped behind his back and his big hat on. And I always said good morning to him, but he always ignored me, whoever he was. In those days, and I just thought, oh, that's not a bad job. You can just ignore people. You can still get about a bit. But the idea of becoming a cop sort of grew inside me.
Yeah.
And much to my mother's, I think, is chagrin perhaps the word? I don't know. Because she was convinced if I joined the first day on patrol, somebody would shoot me. I joined the police in 1975 when I was 19.
Right. Our impression, I mean, the public's general impression, especially about British policing, is it has changed quite a bit since the 70s. Would you say that's generally true, or is that just kind of a myth?
No, I think it has changed a lot. I think it's a lot more professional than it was.
Yeah.
Certainly a lot more politically correct, but and in some ways that has probably skews what it does.
Right.
But in those days it was quite, I think it was quite hard for police women to progress to any great levels. They were always the ones that had to look after the kids. So it was a cultural thing. Political correctness didn't really exist in those days. And I think it was very difficult for police women to progress. But what I think is that it was a cultural thing that was across society, but it was within the police as well.
The impression that we get from TV programs like The Sweeney and Life on Mars and programs like that is that there was quite a bit of violence in the 70s within the sort of the police system. Was that true, or did you have any experience of that kind of a thing?
I think there was to a certain degree. I mean, it was just old-fashioned.
Did you have any personal experiences in those early days that sort of reflect the kind of the differences, you would say, between then and now?
What, in terms of
police? Well, the violence and
the violence. I think probably one of, again, I'm slightly changing what I've said, but is there wasn't the checks that are in place now that there were then.
Oh, I see.
There's nothing enshrined in law about the way that prisoners should be dealt with.
Right.
And so, you know, I had an experience of interviewing somebody who had arrested for, a young lad had arrested for committing criminal damage in Blackburn Town Centre. And he wasn't admitting it.
Right.
And he was over, and we interrogated them in those days. We didn't interview them.
Oh, okay.
Which is a big...
A connotation difference.
Yeah, there's quite a big difference, really. Even though they're probably next to each other in the dictionary. You know, I mean, I didn't experience a lot of it. I mean, I was just a general patrol officer.
Sure,
and
sure.
I arrested people and dealt with them myself, usually, and didn't have... But it did happen.
Okay.
There's no two ways about it. It did happen.
Yeah.
You know, there are some horror stories which I'd hate to sort of resurrect now.
Right.
But things change, and I think it's because of that things changed quite a lot.
Right,
in the
right, right, okay.
As the '80s came in.
Yeah.
You know, the stop search laws that existed were, particularly in London, were, overused and abused by the police.
Yeah.
And that resulted in riots.
So they cleaned up their act quite a bit.
And the Police and Criminal Evidence Act came into being in 1984-85.
Right.
And that said, this is how you deal with prisoners.
Difference.
This is what their rights are.
Yeah.
And although there was a big, you know, police officer saying, we'll never do it now, we'll never be able to convict people.
Yeah.
It didn't stop convictions happening. It just meant that we did it properly.
Yeah.
You know, and people were allowed, you know, to have reviews of custody.
Yeah.
In the days before that, you just kept people in custody. There was no set times, really.
Oh, okay.
And
you could keep them as long as you wanted.
Almost.
For weeks or whatever.
Well, I wouldn't say weeks,
but
that the fact that is, if somebody is arrested now, after 6 hours, their custody is reviewed.
Right. Oh,
after another 6 hours, it's reviewed. After another 6 hours, it's reviewed.
Yeah.
And if nothing's happened after 24 hours,
and that changed significantly in the '80s. Then, would you say?
Yeah, it did. Yeah, that came. Police and Criminal Evidence Act came about in the mid-80s.
Right.
And the whole way that the police operated changed quite a lot.
That must have been quite a shock to certain police officers.
A shock, and I think at the beginning there was, I mean, I was a custody officer in the '90s, and God bless them, CID would always still try and pull a fast one if they could.
Yeah.
You know, you weren't allowed to interview people in cells anymore. So on TV, if you see somebody being interviewed in a cell or a cell corridor or being interviewed without a solicitor present, particularly for a serious offence, such as murder,
right,
it would never, ever happen. But it makes good drama.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and if you see a psychiatrist or a psychologist in with them, very rare for that to happen, I would say.
Right.
As well, because it's down to detectives or police officers to do the interviews.
Yeah.
And they're very tightly controlled and recorded and videoed.
Yeah, so it's all changed quite a bit since.
So yeah, but if for the purpose of drama, you've got to get rid of these things.
Poetic license.
It's boring, you see.
Yeah, of course it is, yeah. Okay, well, we'll have a little bit of a break there because I think you brought some music along with you.
Yeah.
And we'll hear the first of your tunes, after which I'm going to ask you why you brought this particular one. This is Tumbling Dice by the Rolling Stones.
Oh,
Okay, that was Tumbling Dice by the Rolling Stones. Nick, any particular reason that you chose that?
Can I say other than I just love the Rolling Stones?
Oh, right, okay.
They've been with me probably all of my life.
Yeah.
And I do remember, even now, their first appearance on Top of the Pops.
Yeah.
It was in black and white.
Yeah.
And I think just into 1971, and they released a song called Brown Sugar. And I watched that on TV, and I was just blown away by it. And I still am blown
still
away by it.
Rolling Stones.
Yeah,
fan.
I love them. I've seen them quite a few times. And, you know, and as much as they've, whatever they've been through.
Yeah, I remember growing up there in the 60s in the States, yeah. They were very popular.
They're still massively popular.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
You know, as whatever they've been through and whatever they've done, as role models
yeah.
for somebody who's.
Tumbling
70,
Dice, though, isn't 70. One of their most famous songs.
It isn't, but it's from an album called Exile on Main Street.
Right.
Which was the one that they recorded when they were sort of forced out of Britain for tax reasons,
yeah.
and they went to live on the Riviera
for six months.
Hard life, yeah. Ah. When we say they're short of money, it's the different world of being short of money than me. But I just love them. I think they're brilliant musicians as a unit.
Yeah.
And as I was saying, as role models for somebody who is 70 years old and still
great. Performing. Yeah. Anyway, getting back to you and your writing. When did you get started in writing? I think there was a competition. Was there in the police force that you entered?
Well, I tried throughout the 1980s. I tried to get published. I wrote three novels in the 1980s that came back because it was the very much the days of the slush pile in publishing.
What does that mean?
Well, that means that your novel turns up at a you know, you post it to a publisher and they just put it on a pile.
Put
it on the bottom of a pile and eventually they get to it and probably eventually it comes back to you. But I'd written three novels in the 1980s, which all came back to me.
Right.
But at the same time, there was a magazine called Police Review, which doesn't exist anymore. And it changed its format quite a lot over the years. But in the 1980s, it still published a little bit of fiction, short stories and poems and stuff like that were police related. And they had a short story competition one year. I think it ran for 3 years, actually. But on the first year that it ran, I had a go at it and I wrote a story called Home and Family, which was a little vignette, really, about a police officer going to the sudden death of a child, and it's nothing more than that, really. It's probably not even 700 words long. But I sent it off, and lo and behold, I won the competition, which was a big surprise to me.
Yeah,
but also a big boost as well.
Sure, of course it would be.
You know, because I was getting the books back as well as being rejected by publishers. And the prize, there was a financial prize, which was, I think, about £150, which was pretty good in those days.
Yeah.
But also, I was invited down to London to meet the editors of Police Review and have lunch with them, and also Dick Francis. He was one of my heroes then.
He was well known,
massively well known thriller. Well, obviously, ex jockey.
Yeah.
Queen's jockey or whatever, Queen Mother's jockey.
But I've read some of his work, it's good stuff.
And he started right after a big fall that kind of stopped him riding.
Right.
He started writing thrillers in the 60s.
Yeah.
And he was massive, certainly in this country, he's massive.
Yes.
Massive
well, massive, in the States too,
I think he was. So I met him, and I also met at the lunch Peter Walker, who is the author of the books that became the Heartbeat series on TV,
which was a very long-running
country-based, based in Yorkshire, series about the police, about uniform police. He writes under a different name, but his real name is Peter Walker. And it was a great lunch, and Dick Francis got drunk. Which was great, which was all right for him, because he then just fell into a chauffeur-driven limousine that was whisked away. But during the course of that, the important thing for me was that they were full of advice about writing. And I went basically with a list of questions about how I should progress with writing and all that sort of thing.
Well, obviously getting published is about persistence, but what advice, can you remember some of the advice that you were given by them? And
it's a long time ago. Isn't it? That's a good question. That put me on the...
Under a bit of pressure.
No, I think the advice to me was when I listened to them about being published, and Peter Walker particularly. I mean, Dick Francis came into writing with... he was well known anyway.
He already had celebrities.
So he had a bit of status already.
Yeah.
Peter Walker didn't, and he had to graft.
It was harder for him.
Yeah, and he'd written a lot, and he was a cop as well, but he just retired. And he'd written whilst being in the police.
Had you always wanted to write? I mean, from when you were a child, or would you say?
When did
the bug bite you? I mean, or does it go way back so far that you...
It goes a long way back. I think that the bug comes from reading to start with.
Right.
And then thinking, I wonder if I could do that. I like the thought of doing that.
Yeah, yeah. Did you have some favourite authors back then that you... Can you remember anybody?
And I think it's a little bit about... It's like music as well. I think what's favourite in your youth tends to stick with you.
Because I used to read, like, the Hardy Boys and Nancy Drew. I don't know if you've ever heard of them.
I have, absolutely. And they've had TV series, of course, haven't they, those sort of things. But, I've never read one, to be honest. But,
okay.
My growing up reading was Tarzan.
Oh, yeah, okay. Edgar Rice Burroughs.
Jungle Book, Rudyard Kipling and... And then eventually moving on to Ian Fleming, when I was just sort of approaching my teens and reading James Bond books. And what I liked then was if I liked a book, I would try and find out about the author.
Yeah, okay.
And of course, in those days, you didn't have the internet. You actually had to go into a library or whatever.
Do you think it's important to know the author's personal background and a little bit about the author? Does that inform your reading? Do you think, or do you think that might prejudice you when you were reading something? If you found out something about an author, would that color the way that you read the book, or do you think you can separate your knowledge of the author from the book that you're reading?
I think it's probably sometimes perhaps a bad idea to find out about an author.
Yeah.
But I mean, I did it because I wanted to see how they came about and got published.
Right.
And how they wrote and
that
kind of thing. I mean, Hemingway, who I did for A level, who has been with me ever since as well.
Yeah, I like Hemingway.
If you know a lot about Hemingway in his private life, he was a horrible man, and also a wonderful man.
Yeah.
He swung from end to end, I think.
Yeah.
But I like to read about how he wrote and what his routine was and things like that.
Because he wrote standing up, didn't he?
Standing up.
You don't do that, do you? You don't stand up.
Well, only when my back goes.
Okay.
So, but you start reading about Hemingway and you think, what a life he had as well.
Yeah, yeah.
But Fleming, what the thing about Fleming was that, of course, he used, as he started after the war and when he started writing James Bond books, he used to go to Jamaica every year for 3 or 4 months on his typewriter, Goldeneye.
At
Goldeneye. And I used to think, it must be really good being a writer.
So they inspired you?
They inspired me. Not that I've done
their
that.
Their lifestyle
is good. I like the thought that you can do it anywhere.
Yeah, yeah.
You can still do it anywhere. All you need, you still only need a pencil and a piece of paper.
So you've reached a stage now where if you want to, you can go to Jamaica for 3 months every
year. Not Jamaica, but I have written on a beach.
In
Greece and stuff like that.
Yeah.
I
think I remember reading about that because you had quite a tight timeline.
That was with the novelization. Yeah. But prior to that, I'd spent a week or two on a beach in Zante, in Greece, just writing one of the books. And I actually think that it's one of my turned out to be one of my favourite books of my own. I like them all. But I do think that the fact that I wrote it in the sun probably has prejudices my viewpoint of that book as well.
Okay.
And I somehow do think...
You have happy memories of writing that book.
Yeah, I did, very much. Yeah. So... But I did like reading about the writers as well as reading the words.
It's fairly clear that you enjoy writing, that you enjoy doing that. Isn't that's kind of important, isn't it, that you enjoy the writing? Because not everybody's going to get published, are they? Not everybody's going to be a successful writer. So would you say one of the important aspects is enjoying doing the writing? Or?
The enjoyment's changed slightly, though, because once that first book was published, then there's a pressure.
Right.
To, you know, when I had the first book, I'm sure we'll talk about it, but when the first book was published, and I managed to get a literary agent, and he then got me a deal to have that one published and a second one published.
Oh, right. Then you're under pressure.
And then you're under pressure to meet a deadline, right. And things do change slightly.
Okay.
Not that it means that I don't enjoy it, still love it, but when you're suddenly say in 4 months' time you've got to have a book completed, then that puts a different
perspective
in your mind.
Okay, well, maybe we'll have a little break again for another tune that you've brought with us. This is called Mystery Train by the man that we all know as Elvis.
Yeah.
Train arrived, 16 coaches long. Train a ride, 16 coaches long. Well, that long black train got my baby and gone. Train, train, coming round the bend. Train, train, coming right on the bend. Well, it took my baby, but it never will again. No, not again. Train, train, coming down the line. Train, train, coming down the line. Well, it's bringing my baby, 'cause she's mine, oh, mine, she's mine, oh, mine. Train, train, coming round the bend, round the bend. Train, train, coming round the bend, round the bend. Well, it took my baby, but it never will again, never will again.
Okay, that was Mystery Train by Elvis. Again, not one of his most famous songs. Is there a reason that you chose that one in particular?
Well, for Elvis, first of all, his soundtrack was always in the house, because my eldest brother was a big Elvis fan.
Right, okay.
But also there's a slight link as well to the Rolling Stones with that, because I love the song.
Yeah.
Mystery Train, great, great, great song. Done by a lot of people as well. A lot of versions of it. But I do remember reading an interview with Keith Richards, who said one of the things, you know, he used to listen to, obviously, all sorts of music when he was growing up and try to emulate stuff on guitar and copy stuff. And one of the solos that he could never work out was the one that Scotty Moore did on Mystery Train.
Right.
And it was always the song itself was always a mystery to him, and how the music was put together, and it is to me, and just a great little song.
So that mystery itself.
So a great guitarist like Keith Richards could not even work out what Scotty Moore was doing. Which I think says something about Scotty Moore. You know, he was fabulous.
Well, getting back to the writing thing. there are lots of areas that I try to talk about in my interviews, lots of aspects of writing. I mean, when you decide that you're going to write a new book, how do you approach that? What goes through your mind? Do you work on characters, plots, themes, anything in particular first, or a continuation of what you've been writing, or does this something have to strike you and say, oh yeah, I want to write about that?
All those things
all at the same time.
Well, that's a cheap answer, isn't it? But,
No, it's all right.
There's all sorts of things that go on in the head. You know, there are subject areas that I'd like to have a go at.
Yeah.
You know, particularly in these days when sort of people trafficking and drugs trafficking is always in the news.
What's relevant to now?
Yeah, and I always think, well, maybe could I get a story there? I mean, for example, some of the books, use the mafia in Lancashire.
Yeah.
And you would think, well, wait a minute, that doesn't seem right, that the mafia are operating in Lancashire. But historically, and also up to date, that, you know, there are always stories about people on the run from the Italian police who were part of the mafia.
So you mean the Italian mafia in Lancashire?
Yeah.
So there is an Italian mafia in Lancashire.
Yeah. Oh, right. And there are people who were always being found who were on the run from the police in Italy.
Yeah.
Or on the run from the mob in Italy.
From Lancashire, they've run out.
They've
to
run
Italy.
From Italy, and they're now living in Lancashire.
Oh, or Lancashire. Or does that work vice versa? If they go from Lancashire back to Italy, if they've committed a crime in Lancashire, do they?
Oh
not
no,
run
no, I don't. That would probably not. But
it's usually the other way.
Yeah,
Italy to Lancashire. Okay.
Yeah. So I mean, you know, somebody who was on the run from, I think, from the mob in Italy was running a shoe shop in Preston.
Oh, right.
You know, and I thought, well, that's a good sort of premise.
Yeah, sure.
A good beginning for a story.
Yeah.
So that's that, and it built from that a story called The Hidden Witness.
Other counties in England, are there mafia connections? Do you think, or is it? Just
I would
Lancashire?
Guess so. It's only because
oh,
I.
Oh right,
read
it's not
about
just
them.
Lancashire where this might occur.
But also, you know, that one of the big influences or one of the starting points for me was a goes back to 1979 when a handless corpse was fished out of a flooded quarry near Chorley.
Right, this is a true story.
This is a true story.
Yeah.
And as the story for the reality of that was that it was somebody who'd been murdered in Lancashire and tried to cut his hands off and dump his body.
Yeah.
And it turned out that he was from Australia. And then the story came out of this worldwide drug trade, drug routes,
right.
And he'd been skimming his boss and all that sort of thing. And so it happens in Lush, what I'm saying.
So you use reality to kind of inform your fiction.
Because there is
a difference in fiction and reality.
Yeah,
but sometimes, do you think that the two kind of merge together at times, or do you just take the sort of the bare bones of a real story and then convert it, would you say?
Kind of. Yeah, because the thing about the guy that ran the shoe shop became an old man that ran a dress shop.
Okay. You sort of modified it.
Yeah, and I know that the name of the particular mafia group escapes me, but they one of the specialisms is producing clothes that they put false labels on.
Okay.
You know, so that the designer clothes.
Fraud. Yeah.
They're fraud.
Yeah, yeah.
And they're, you know, they're produced in Italy and they come here.
Right.
And they're sold at the same price as the expensive. Yeah, and I thought, well, that's kind of a good
story.
I can use that. Yeah. But also, you know, I like to use where I've been on holiday if I can.
Yeah.
Not that I get any tax breaks for that.
Yeah.
You know, and I do like to put an overseas link in the stories if I can.
Okay.
But not always. And that's the commercial view as well. Really.
Yeah.
And some of the early books were partly set in America because I've been to Florida.
Right.
You know, and I'd used quite a few of the locations that I've been to in Florida in the earlier books, but it's a long time since I've been to America. So those have sort of faded away, really.
Yeah. Anyway, we'll have a little bit of a break for another tune. I Feel Fine by the Beatles. Thank you.
she's happy as can be. You know she said so. I'm in love with her and I feel fine. Baby says she's mine. You know she tells me all the time. You know she said so. I'm in love with her and I feel fine. I'm so glad that she's my little girl. She's so glad she's telling the whole world that her baby buys her things, you know. He buys her diamond rings, you know. She said so. She's in love with me and I feel fine. She's mine, you know. She tells me all the time, you know. She said so. I'm in love with her and I feel fine. I'm so glad that she's my little girl. She's so glad she's telling all the world that her baby buys her things, you know. He buys her diamond rings, you know. She said so. She's in love with me and I feel fine. She's in love with me and I feel fine.
Okay, that was I Feel Fine by the Beatles. Reasons, Nick, for choosing that one?
Yeah, again, another part of the soundtrack of the home,
yeah,
in the 60s,
growing up and all that.
Yeah, my brother, that's just a bit older than me, was a big Beatles fan.
Yeah,
couldn't really not put a Beatles song in, and it's just one of, it could have been any of the Beatles songs, really.
Do you listen to music while you're writing? Do you like a silent room? How do you write? Do you like to go into your own office, or well, I know you've said you write on the beach sometimes.
Well, if I can find a beach, I'll write on it. We have a study that used to be the garage.
Yeah.
So I write there, but I also like to write, and I do like it silent. I'm not one that can write with anything going on, really.
Yeah, yeah.
Although I don't mind a bit of background noise. So I either write there, or in the dining room that overlooks the garden.
Right.
The back of the house.
Yeah.
Or over somewhere. Even yesterday I was trying, because the sun kept coming out and then going in yesterday. And when it came out, I went and sat in the garden and wrote.
Right.
I quite like writing.
So you don't mind writing in different places, then, it sounds like?
I like writing in different places.
Yeah.
I'm not one that can, you know, you hear about writers that like going to cafes and things like that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I like the thought of being able to do that, but actually the reality of getting a pen and pad out or whatever in a cafe doesn't quite gel with me.
Do you work to a time scale? I mean, well, obviously you've had some pressure on you in the past, but would you say on a daily basis that you work from like 9 to 5? Are you a 9 to 5, 5 days a week sort of a writer, or?
Well, the house tends to empty around about 8:15 in the morning.
Right.
My partner goes to work, children go to school.
Yeah.
And from then till about 3 o'clock is the writing day. I've worked to deadlines now.
Yeah.
I don't have any at the moment, anyway. For the past 5 years or something like that, I've been writing about 2 books a year anyway.
Right.
So I say a year, it's usually 7 months.
Yeah.
7 months is a book, 7 months is a book.
So it's important to be quite disciplined about it. If you want to be a professional writer, it's important to be disciplined and.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's one of the good things that makes you do it. Of course,
yeah.
But I mean, I hate deadlines, but then again, if I didn't have them,
I'd
procrastinate it would never happen.
Do you find that you get distracted easily, or you would do, if you didn't have these deadlines?
I'm easily distracted anyway. I will easily go and do the ironing. I will easily go and watch Frasier.
Yeah. You'll do something else instead.
Yeah. And then when I'm doing that, I'm thinking, well, why am I doing this?
I should be writing.
I am easily distracted, but I am, in my mind, I don't feel disciplined, but I am disciplined.
Yeah.
And I have to be, because Again, I was just on the way over today, I was just thinking that since the beginning of last year and to the end of this year, I will have written 7 novels. And I kind of think that's fairly disciplined.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, that's very disciplined. Sure.
You know, with, there'll be 4 Henry Christie novels within that.
Yeah.
And 3 novelizations of...
How many have you written so far? Do you know how many of you've...
Henry Christie's.
Well, no, all your novels, would you say? Can you put a number on it?
26, I think.
26. That's pretty good. And how long a period of time? I mean, is that since the 80s or...?
No, the first novel that was published in 1996.
Was that A Time for Justice?
That was A Time for Justice,
right,
yeah.
Okay.
So I was still in the police then.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was in the police, and I retired at the end of 2005. So whilst I was in the police, I tended to write 1 a year.
Oh, right,
that,
okay.
Well, yeah, of course. Full-time job to write, you know, that's how I did it.
How did you do that? Did you go up early in the morning, or did you write late at night, or...? How did you do that with
usually evening times? I mean, I was sort of fortunate in a lot of ways because by that time in my service, in my police service, I was working at headquarters as a police trainer. So generally speaking, I was doing a 9-to-5
right,
weekends
okay.
off job.
Did you have to be careful not to include any kind of obviously anything that was sensitive to do with your job in your writing? I mean, there were certain things that obviously, certain cases that presumably that you couldn't use in your writing because it would have, for legal reasons, or
that's never really been a problem.
No, that's not been a problem.
No, but okay. You know, I've never been involved in that many anyway.
Okay.
I've only been an observer in those things.
Yeah.
And a lot of the sensitive stuff I've only ever read in newspapers or in the media.
Right. Well, then then it's open. You can use all
that. Yeah, I would use what anybody else can use.
Yeah, yeah.
And I've always tried to make sure I do that,
yeah.
Even though I might know something.
Yeah.
One of the things that I did use, though, I mean, I was, whilst I was at headquarters as a trainer, I became a manager of trainers. So I used to be able to go in and watch people delivering training.
Right.
If you will.
Yeah.
And I went in and watched some of the CID courses that were on, and you know they would bring
in. So you learned some.
They would bring in undercover officers.
Oh,
so,
okay.
And I would go. I might just come in and watch that.
Yeah.
And whilst I never would use what they told.
Specific incidents
that
yeah.
they told, which
yeah,
was,
yeah.
I mean, who would be an undercover officer? No, thank you.
Yeah. Mind you, sometimes the truth is so unbelievable that you can't use it in fiction anyway.
Yeah, well, bits I used. I mean,
I've
had Henry Christie as an undercover officer
yeah.
in some of the novels.
Okay.
Again, if you see it on telly that an undercover officer is working in a prison, it will never happen.
Right.
An undercover officer will never work within 60 or 70 miles of their own home anyway.
Okay.
But they, you know, they obviously do get involved with the people that they're trying to nail.
Well, there's a lot of controversy now about those
yeah.
interpersonal relationships.
Yeah,
that
yeah.
Just,
and it must be so easy to happen.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
Of course.
You know, and even then they were talking about, you know, the 2 Christmas dinners. So that, you know, with the people who they were trying to put away, they would have the Christmas dinner with them.
Yeah, yeah.
And then they would have
to
go home and have Christmas dinner with the family, you know, and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And it was fascinating, but I would never ever use the actual incidents that they talked
no,
about.
No, of course not.
But the way that they're recruited and the courses that they have to go through are very stressful. And
I know in the first book that there's a kind of a certain, or shall I call it, a gangster element, and to much of your work there is this kind of gangster aspect to it. Is it, why are you so fascinated by, or are you, am I right in assuming that you're interested in that?
I am pretty interested.
Character.
Yeah, and I think that probably stems from, again, one of my great influences is The Godfather.
Right, okay.
You know, and the book The Godfather,
yeah.
as opposed to the film, really, even though it's very, very similar.
Yeah.
And I just thought, interesting. It's interesting stuff in the underworld. It's a fascination, particularly, and a lot of the settings were in Blackpool. I'm sorry,
yeah.
I didn't mean to interrupt or anything. But,
no, that's okay.
You know, and I thought, again, going, one of the books is Blackpool a few years ago was talking about opening casinos along the front and all that sort of stuff. And
yeah.
I thought, if they open a casino on the front, what's going to happen? The mob's going to come in. Whatever this, that's what they do.
Yeah.
You know, and
In real life, that's the truth. That will happen. Yeah.
So I wrote one of my novels sort of based around that as well.
Yeah.
Even though the casinos have never happened.
There's a fairly clear distinction, it seems to me, between good and evil in your book. You seem to sort of have a very strong sense of the good guy and the bad guy, and I'm not trying to sort of put any kind of connotation on that. Would you say that's a conscious sort of attempt on your part to sort of distinguish between good and evil? Do you think there is that kind of aspect to life, that good and evil does exist?
I think good and evil is a strategy.
Right. Okay.
You know, but underneath that, not everybody's completely good, and not everybody's completely evil.
Right.
Even the most evil people have got good points.
Have got some good.
You know, and what I like to do is, again, I don't know whether I achieve this. Is even if they're a bad character, a bad person, I kind of like to give them a rounded character.
Right.
So that.
Not just one-dimensional characters.
I'm not saying that there aren't one-dimensional characters for the purpose of plot sometimes.
Yeah, yeah.
One of the biggest villains in one-dimensional character is John Grisham. But he writes fabulous books. But what I'm saying, and I'm not knocking him, I love him. I'd always try and like to think that if my character, any of the characters in the book, so long as they don't get killed, that you think that they've had a life before you come to them, and that they will have a life after.
Right.
I kind of like that feel of my characters as well. And the bad guys are ultimately the bad guys, but, you know, they're not completely.
How meticulously do you plan a book before you write it? Do you plan sort of in significant detail before you, chapter by chapter? Do you sort of outline chapter before you write the book, or do you kind of give yourself some leeway to sort of go in any particular direction?
It'll start off, first of all, when I'm thinking about it, I have literally this week just started the new Henry Christie novel.
Yeah.
Which has to be done by Christmas.
Yeah.
So that's, I've got a 4-month writing period. And what I always start with when I'm doing ideas is probably just jot little words down that, you know, what I want to write about. So this one is, it's about, generally speaking, in terms of geography, I use real places.
Yeah.
In Lancashire. But there's one or two of the books I have invented a village that sits in the north of the, and people have said to me, I've looked for that on the map and I can't find it. Because it doesn't exist. It's just a little amalgam of a few villages that So I wanted to set one there, and I wanted to bring a new character in that would be the new, for want of a better term, the new village Bobby.
Yeah.
Now, Henry Christie is going to marry the lady that runs the hotel in that village.
Oh, right, okay.
So Henry Christie is ultimately going to marry a landlady.
Okay.
What could be better?
Yeah.
What could be better for any man?
Yeah.
Anyway.
Well, they'll get lots to meet lots of people and lots of different, you can introduce lots of different characters coming and staying. That's a quite
so
a
good idea. And also he's obviously virtually at the end of his service.
Yeah.
So, and I have to be thinking about that. I mean, I can go back and write stories historically or what is going to happen.
Yeah.
Realistically, Henry has got to retire. Because they are in chronological
order. The first book started
probably when he was about 40.
Yeah.
You know, he's virtually at 60 now.
So that.
But I wanted to write a book about a new character that takes over the village, being a village cop.
Well, maybe we'll break there for a bit more music. Maggie May by Rod Stewart.
Oh, try anymore. You led me away from home just to save you from being alone. You stole my soul, and that's a pain I can do without. All I needed was a friend to lend a guiding hand, but you turned into a lover and mother. What a lover, you wore me out. All you did was wreck my bed, and in the morning kick me in the head. Oh, Maggie, I couldn't have tried anymore. You led me away from home, 'cause you didn't wanna be alone. You stole my heart, I couldn't leave you if I tried.
Okay, that was Maggie May by Rod Stewart. Nick, tell us a little bit about why you chose that one.
Yeah, another great rock icon, I think. Again, from pretty much from my youth. But I like Rod because he's a good songwriter as well. It's not as well, you know, he's got some great songs and he does covers very well.
Yeah.
But some of the songs that he's written, like Maggie May, tell really good stories. And I like that in a songwriter.
Right.
And it's not so much well known, I think, about Rod.
Have you ever written any poetry yourself? Have you ever had a go at sort of songwriting or writing poetry or anything like that?
Well, I used to be in a band and we used to write our own songs. I used to write.
What did you do in the band? Did you play guitar?
I played guitar and a little bit of backing singing, but not a very good strong, I didn't have a strong voice or anything.
Yeah.
But we wrote a few songs, which again, I like being creative.
You still keep in touch with a lot of the other band members? Do you ever
see
them
anymore? No.
We just went different ways, you know, in the band. Yeah. Was that in the Accrington area or was that?
No, this is while I was in the police.
Oh, right. Okay.
So I had a couple of bands whilst I was in the police. Probably the last time I played in a band was probably about 2003, something like that.
That's not so long ago.
No.
Not so far. No,
I play my guitar every day, but I don't try and write songs anymore.
Yeah. Do your kids play any instruments?
My son plays guitar. He's not so bad.
Yeah.
The others are not particularly into music as such.
Anyway, to get back to the writing, we were talking a little bit about good and evil and about sort of your approaches to characterization, and you said you liked making multidimensional characters who, you know, no character is all good or all bad. How do you approach the violence thing? Do you have limits on, you know, some of your characters are obviously more violent than others. Some are victims. Aren't they of the violence?
Yeah.
And some are the perpetrators of the violence. But do you draw a line? Do you sort of say, well, this is a particular aspect of violence that I'm not going to cross in terms of describing the violence?
I think in terms of probably of violence to children and to women is the line I probably wouldn't cross as such. I'm not saying that, you know, that if there was a rape that I would not go describe the rape.
Right.
I think I would say the rape occurred, if you will, and then deal with the aftermath of it.
Yeah. So you wouldn't go into a lot of detail
about the rape itself. No, it's not, or against children, you know, and if a child, and I have dealt with murders of teenage girls and thing, but it's what happens after rather than the event itself,
I think, is what
I would it's deal important. With.
How it gets resolved, how that sort of gets addressed.
Yeah, and the actual, you know, sort of a graphic description of a young girl being killed or whatever is not something that is a road that I would necessarily go down. I just think it's appropriate for the story.
Yeah. How do they go about solving, your detective, Henry Christie, how does he go about solving a crime? Does he rely on this forensics and this evidence and this team of people, or is it kind of like he just kind of goes around and
well,
slogs
again,
away?
Well, again, what do you want? Do you want reality or do you want drama?
Well, I think we've already established fiction is different from reality.
It just is. And I like to allude to the fact that, all right, he's got a team. And forensics happen and all that kind of stuff goes on.
Yeah.
But somehow you've got to draw the story to your detective.
Right. It's
about not real. What Henry does is not real.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think what drives him though is that he wants justice.
Yeah.
To be done for people who he believes he's there. And one of the books is called Fighting for the Dead. That's what he thinks he's here for. And he will follow that route.
Right.
You know, if he's dealing with the murder of somebody, what he believes he's here for is to find out the person who did that murder and let them face justice. And then whatever happens in the judicial system happens.
So he's got a strong sense of right and wrong.
Yeah, very much.
And would you say that reflects your own sort of personal kind of, can I call it a crusade? It's probably not a crusade, but your own kind of feelings about life, universe, and everything, that right and wrong is something that you want your readers to sort of be aware of and think about? And
I think I do. But I also want to throw into the mix that life isn't quite that simple.
Right, yeah.
You know, life is very complicated and it's nice to have black and white, if you will, or right and wrong and all that sort of stuff.
But reality is just a bit of
grey.
Yeah.
Life. But to have somebody, you know, I was once giving a talk to a library, to a group, I think it was some sort of women's ladies readers. And one of the ladies said, I don't like thinking of Lancashire Constabulary detectives being like that. And I said, well, actually, I do. I said, I'm not bothered what they do in their private lives. What I want is a detective. If I get killed, you know, and it's not an accident or whatever, I want a detective. I don't care if he's a bit of a womanizer or whatever.
Yeah.
I don't care if he's divorced. What I want a detective to come along and look at my body and say, I'm going to find out who killed you. That's what I want.
You want justice to
have been served. And I'm not, you know, my stories are about him doing that, but also having to face what goes on in his private life and professional life as well. But as long as they're doing what they're supposed to be.
Yeah. Do you think the police force become more political? You think it's more politicized in the sense that they're, because of this scrutiny, like politicians are under scrutiny, do you think that affects does that influence their effectiveness as a police force? So I think you said earlier that
it's very, very politicized. And one of the things that drew me to being a cop was that politicians didn't have an effect on what I did. What they do,
yeah,
and that, and I think that changed very much in the 1980s with the miners.
Yeah, I was going to say,
you know, which I, you know, I went from here to various mining communities and policed what was going on.
Oh yeah,
you know, and we were doing the government's bidding. I think it might be too simple just to say that, but
yeah,
and I think the world of the police changed then over that period of time, 1984-ish.
Right.
But now. I mean, I look at it now. I'm glad I'm out of it, I'll be honest.
Right. And you think it's been weakened to that extent, that the police force, that they can't really do their job as well as they should be doing?
And it's a shame, really, because I know that, you know, change is a constant, obviously.
Yeah, yeah.
And cutting back is a constant. And even from when I was in the job in the middle of the 90s, say, we were changing then. We were constantly cutting and cutting and cutting and paring things back and paring things back.
Yeah, yeah.
And it still goes on, and they still expect more and more paring back. And that's, but also that has the effect that, like I said, I think they're more professional in what they do because they're more focused.
Yeah.
Because they have to be, because they haven't, you know, the days of me driving around on patrol and just doing what I felt like, they're gone.
Right. You're accountable for
everything.
You're accountable. Every
this is what your
day.
Job is today. You will do this. You know, these are the areas I want you to look at. This is what the supervision will be telling people.
Okay. Well, we'll have a break for a song. This is a song I don't know, so this will be interesting for me to hear. Do You Want the Truth by Paloma Faith?
It's actually Do You Want the Truth or Something Beautiful, it's called.
Oh, right. Or Something Beautiful. Okay. Yeah. Okay, that was Do You Want the Truth by Paloma Faith. Do you want to tell us, Nick, why you chose that one in particular?
It was sort of a couple of years back. It was, I think, probably about her first single released. And back then it was sort of a summertime hit, and it was with us when we were on holiday in Menorca.
Oh, right, okay. Happy memories.
Yeah, happy memories. And of course, she is just marvellous talent. I think she's fantastic, and she's gone on to produce some fantastic work since.
Nick, I believe you've been approached by Lancashire Authors to be a patron.
That's very true. It's an honour that, you know, they thought of me and actually approached me, and it's something that I will be doing.
Okay, great. That's good to hear. I think Lancashire, well, I don't know if you know, Lancashire Authors has been going since 1909. It's been for a long time, and quite a few sort of well-known people have been members of Lancashire Authors over the years. So you're in good company, so it's great to have you aboard, and certainly we look forward to reading your work, and I'm sure that there'll be lots of Lancashire Authors members who will rush out and buy your books.
Well, I hope so.
Okay, that's great. Well, I think we've come to the stage where we're going to wind things up a little bit. Nick, thanks very much for being with us today. It's been brilliant. I've really enjoyed what you've had to say, and I've learned a lot from it, and interesting stories and interesting aspects to how you approach writing and your writing, which I think will be helpful to anybody out there who's listening who wants to sort of get involved in doing some writing themselves and enjoying it. And certainly good luck with the future. It sounds like you're doing very well and sort of working your way up the ladder there, and good luck with your film, you know, the novelization of your films. I think you've got another one that you're
another one coming out at the end of the year.
Yeah. And your Henry Christie new novel coming out end of December.
Yeah.
So all exciting stuff for
it's
all your
all
fans.
It's all good stuff.
All great stuff.
Yeah.
So thanks again, Nick, and good luck.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.